And good afternoon, it's Rod McClure here with our Monday afternoon book reading. And before we get to our sponsors, just a couple of quick things. The Braidwood Scouts are holding a car boot sale this week on Saturday the 11th of March. It's a 9 a.m. start. There has been a little flyer come around to, I think, most of the letterboxes in town, but it's a very worthy cause. The Scout group are, you know, thriving at the moment. And it's good to see them doing so well. So if you can support the Scout car boot sale this week, Saturday the 11th of March. And to Sandra Hunt, who's requested information on the fish and chip van. Look, it seems to be open Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. A lot depends on weather because they do their own fishing. So Sandra, you sent in that request around about 3 minutes ago. If you're still around the town or listening to 2BRW FM, that's the answer to your question. Well, we'll continue with our book reading in a moment, but a word from the people who help make our little station possible.
Braidwood Butchery. High-quality meats and old-fashioned friendly service. And they also smoke all their own deli range on the premises and are open 5.5 days a week. Braidwood Butchery. 137 Wallace Street, Braidwood. 4842 2472. A proud sponsor of Braidwood FM.
Braidwood Veterinary Surgery has been providing high-quality veterinary services to Braidwood and the surrounds since 1989. Their veterinarians have extensive knowledge of preventative and diagnostic health of all species, no matter how large or small. They're open Monday to Friday, 9 till 5, and Saturdays, 9 till noon. You can call them on 48 42 2697, a proud sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
Braidwood's Half Cut Barber is now open at the Braidwood Hotel, offering traditional grooming services for the men of Braidwood. Walk-ins are welcome. Contact Half Cut Barber Braidwood through their webpage. Proud sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And a big thank you to our sponsors. One more little announcement. A reminder, there's a Meet the Candidates for the seat of Monero, the state election coming up. The Meet the Candidates gathering will be held on Tuesday, March 7th at 7 p.m. at the Braidwood Servicemen's Club. So if you want to come along and have a bit of a listen to what the potential local members have to say, that's where you can come to. And now, continuing on with our reading of Ivanhoe. The Disinherited Knight had no sooner reached his pavilion than the squires and pages in abundance tendered their services to disarm him and bring fresh attire, and to offer him the refreshment of a bath. Their zeal on this occasion was perhaps sharpened by curiosity, since everyone desired to know who the knight was and what had that had gained so many laurels, yet had refused, even at the command of Prince John, to lift his visor or to name his name. But their officious inquisitiveness was not gratified. The Disinherited Knight refused all other assistance save that of his own squire, or rather yeoman, a clownish-looking man who, wrapped in a cloak of dark-coloured felt, and having his head and face half buried in a Norman bonnet made of black fur, seemed to affect the incognito as much as his master. All others being excluded from the tent, this attendant relieved his master from the more burdensome parts of his armour and placed food and wine before him, which the exertions of the day rendered very acceptable. The knight had scarcely finished a hasty meal ere his menial announced to him that 5 men, each leading a barbed steed, desired to speak with him. The Disinherited Knight had exchanged his armour for the long robe usually worn by those of his condition, which, being furnished with a hood, concealed the features when such was the pleasure of the wearer, almost as completely as the visor of the helmet itself. But the twilight, which was now fast darkening, would itself have rendered a disguise unnecessary, unless to persons to whom the face of an individual chanced to be particularly well known. The Disinherited Knight therefore stepped boldly forth to the front of his tent, and found in attendance the squires of the challengers, whom he easily knew by their russet and black dresses, each of whom led his master's charger, loaded with the armour in which he had that day fought. "According to the laws of chivalry," said the foremost of these men, "I, Baldwin d'Aulay, squire to the redoubted knight, Brian de Bois-Guilbert, make offer to you, styling yourself for the present, the disinherited knight, of the horse and armour used by the said Brian de Bois-Guilbert in this day's passage of arms, leaving it with your nobleness to retain or to ransom the same according to your pleasure, for such is the law of arms." The other squires repeated nearly the same formula, and then stood to await the decision of the disinherited knight. "To you, four sirs," replied the knight, addressing those who had last spoken, "and to your honourable and valiant masters, I have one common reply. Commend me to the noble knights, your masters, and say I should do ill to deprive them of steeds and arms, which can never be used by braver cavaliers. I would I could here end my message to these gallant knights, but, being, as I term myself, in truth and earnest, the disinherited, I must be thus far bound to your masters that they will, of their courtesy, be pleased to ransom their steeds and armour, since that which I wear I can hardly term mine own." "We stand commissioned, each of us," answered the squire of Reginald Front de Boeuf, "to offer 100 zecchins in ransom of these horses and suits of armour." "It is sufficient," said the disinherited knight. "Half the sum my present necessities compel me to accept. Of the remaining half, distribute one moiety among yourselves, sir squires, and divide the other half betwixt the heralds and the servants and minstrels and other attendants." The squires, with a cap in hand and low reverence, expressed their deep sense of courtesy and generosity, not often practised, at least on a scale so extensive. The disinherited knight then addressed his discourse to Baldwin the squire of Brian de Bois-Guilbert. "From your master," said he, "I will accept neither arms nor ransom. Say to him in my name that our strife is not ended. No, not till we have fought as well with swords as with lances, as well on foot as on horseback. To this mortal quarrel he has himself defied me, and I shall not forget the challenge. Meantime, let him be assured that I hold him not as one of his companions, with whom I can with pleasure exchange courtesies, but rather as one with whom I stand upon terms of mortal defiance." "My master," answered Baldwin, "knows how to requite scorn with scorn and blows with blows, as well as courtesy with courtesy. Since you disdain to accept from him any share of the ransom at which you have rated the arms of the other knights, I must leave his armour and horse here, being well assured that he will never deign to mount the one or wear the other." "You have spoken well, good squire," said the disinherited knight, "well and boldly, as it beseemeth him to speak who answers for an absent master. Leave not, however, the horse and armour here. Restore them to thy master, or if he scorns to accept them, retain them, good friend, for thine own use. So far as they are mine, I bestow them upon you freely." Baldwin made a deep obeisance, and retired with his companions, and the disinherited knight entered the pavilion. "Thus far, Garth," said he, addressing his attendant, "the reputation of English chivalry hath not suffered in my hands." "And I," said Girth, "for a Saxon swineherd have not ill-played the personage of a Norman squire-at-arms." "Yea, but," answered the disinherited knight, "thou hast ever kept me in anxiety, lest thy clownish bearing should discover thee." "Ha!" said Garth, "I fear discovery from none, saving my playfellow, Wombo the jester, of whom I could never discover whether he was most knave or fool. Yet I could scarce choose but laugh when my old master passed so near me, dreaming all the while that Garth was keeping his porkers many a mile off in the thickets and swamps of Rotherwood. If I am discovered..." "Enough, enough," said the disinherited knight. "Thou knowest my promise." "Nay, for that matter," said Garth, "I will never fail my friend for fear of my skin cutting. I have a tough hide that will bear knife or scourge as well as any boar's hide in my herd. Trust me, I will requite the risk you run for my love, Garth," said the knight. "Meanwhile, I pray you to accept these 10 pieces of gold." I am richer, said Garth, putting them in his pouch, than ever was swineherd or bondsman. And take this bag of gold to Ashby, continued his master, and find out Isaac, the Jew of York, and let him pay himself for the horse and arms with which his credit supplied me. Nay, by St. Dunstan, replied Garth, I will not do it. How, knave, replied his master, wilt thou not obey my commands? Or so they be honest and reasonable and Christian commands, replied Garth. But this is none of these. To suffer the Jew to pay himself would be dishonest, for it would be cheating my master and unreasonable, for it were the part of a fool and unchristian, since it would be plundering a believer to enrich an infidel. See him contented, however, you stubborn varlet, said the disinherited knight. I will do so, said Garth, taking the bag under his cloak and leaving the apartment. And it will go hard, he muttered, but I content him with one half of his own asking. So paying, he departed and left the disinherited knight to his own perplexed ruminations, which upon more accounts than it is now possible to communicate to the reader, were of a nature peculiarly agitating and painful. We must now to the scene of the village of Ashby, or rather a country house in its vicinity, belonging to a wealthy Israelite, with whom Isaac, his daughter and retinue, had taken up their quarters. The Jews, it is well known, being as liberal in exercising the duties of hospitality and charity among their own people, as they are alleged to be reluctant and churlish in extending them to those whom they term Gentiles, and whose treatment of them certainly merited little hospitality at their hand. In an apartment, small indeed, but richly furnished with decorations of an oriental taste, Rebecca was seated on a heap of embroidered cushions, which piled along a low platform that surrounded the chamber, served like the estrada of the Spaniards, instead of chairs and stools. She was watching the motions of her father with a look of anxious and filial affection, while he paced the apartment with a dejected face and disordered step. Sometimes clasping his hands together, sometimes casting his eyes to the roof of the apartment, as one who laboured under a great mental tribulation. "Oh, Jacob!" he exclaimed. "Oh, ye 12 holy fathers of our tribe! What a losing venture is this for one who hath duly kept every jot and tittle of the law of Moses, 50 zecchins wrenched from me at one clutch by the talons of a tyrant!" "But, father," said Rebecca, "you seem to give the gold to Prince John willingly."
"Willingly? The blotch of Egypt upon him! Willingly, saidst thou? Nay, as willing as when, the Gulf of Lyon, I flung over my merchandise to lighten the ship while she laboured in the tempest, robed and seething billows in my choice silks, perfumed their briny foam with myrrh and aloes. Not that an hour of unutterable mystery. I enriched their caverns with gold and silver work. Ah, with my own hands I made the sacrifice."
"But it was a sacrifice which heaven exacted to save our lives," answered Rebecca. "And the God of our fathers has since blessed you with your gettings and your store."
"Nay," answered Isaac. "But if the tyrant lays hold on them as he did today, and compels me to smile while he is robbing me, oh, daughter, disinherited and wandering as we are, the worst evil which befalls our race is that when we are wronged and plundered, all the world laughs around, and we are compelled to suppress our sense of injury, to smile tamely when we would revenge bravely."
"Think not on this, father," said Rebecca. "We also have advantages. The Gentiles are cruel. They are oppressive. And, you know, they are dependent upon the children of Zion, whom they despise and persecute. Without the aid of our wealth, they could neither furnish forth their hosts in war nor their triumphs in peace, and the gold which we lend them returns with increase to our coffers. We are like the herb which flourisheth most when it is most trampled on. Even this day's pageant had not proceeded without the consent of the despised Jew who furnished the means."
"Daughter," said Isaac, "thou hast harped upon another string of sorrow. The goodly steed and the rich armour, equal to the full profit of my adventure with our Kijajarim of Leicester, There's a dead loss too, aye, a loss which swallows up the gains of a week, aye, of the space between two Sabbaths, and yet it may end better than I now think, for 'tis a good youth.
Assuredly, said Rebecca, you shall not repent you of requiting the good deed received of the stranger knight.
I trust so, daughter, said Isaac. I trust too in the rebuilding of Zion, but as well do I hope with my own bodily eyes to see the walls and battlements of the new temple as to see a Christian, yea, the very best Christian, repay a debt to a Jew, unless under the awe of a judge or a jailer.
So saying, he resumed his discontented walk through the apartment, and Rebecca, perceiving that her attempts at consolation only served to awaken new subjects of complaint, wisely desisted from her unavailing efforts, a prudential line of conduct, and we recommend to all who set up for comforts and advisers to follow it in the like circumstances. The evening was now becoming dark, when a Jewish servant entered the apartment and placed upon the table two silver lamps fed with perfumed oil. The richest wines and the most delicate refreshments were at the same time displayed by another Israelitish domestic on a small ebony table inlaid with silver, for in the interior of their homes the Jews refused themselves no expensive indulgences. At the same time, the servant informed Isaac that a Nazarene, so they termed the Christians while conversing among themselves, desired to speak with him. He that would live by traffic must hold himself at the disposal of everyone claiming business with him. Isaac at once replaced on the table the untasted glass of Greek wine which he had just raised to his lips, and saying hastily to his daughter,
Rebecca, veil thyself, commanded the stranger to be admitted.
Just as Rebecca had dropped over her fine features a screen of silver gauze which reached to her feet, the door opened, and Garth entered, wrapped in the ample folds of his Norman mantle. His appearance was rather suspicious than prepossessing, especially as instead of doffing his bonnet, he pulled it still deeper over his rugged brow.
"Art thou Isaac the Jew of York?" said Garth in Saxon. "I am," replied Isaac in the same language, for his traffic had rendered him every tongue spoken in Britain familiar to him. "And who art thou?"
That is not to the purpose, answered Garth.
"As much as my name is to thee, for without knowing thine, how can I hold intercourse with thee?" replied Isaac.
"Oh, easily," answered Garth. "I, being to pay money, must know that I deliver it to the right person. Thou art to receive it, wilt not, I think, care very greatly by whose hands it is delivered."
"Oh," said the Jew, "you are come to pay monies? Holy Father, O Abraham, that altereth our relation to each other. And from whom dost thou bring it?"
"From the disinherited knight," said Garth, "victor in this day's tournament. It is the price of the armour supplied to him by Kirjath Jarim of Leicester, or on thy recommendation. The steed is restored to thy stable. I desire to know the amount of the sum which I am to pay for the armour."
"I said he was a good youth," exclaimed Isaac with joyful exultation. "A cup of wine will do thee no harm," he added, filling and handing to the swineherd a richer draught than Garth had ever before tasted. "And how much money," continued Isaac, "hast thou bought with thee?"
"Holy Virgin," said Garth, setting down the cup, "what nectar these unbelieving dogs drink, while true Christians are fain to quaff ale as muddy and thick as the draught we give to hogs. What money have I bought with me?" continued the Saxon, when he had finished his uncivil ejaculation.
"Even but a small sum. Something in hand the whilst? What, Isaac? Thou must bear a conscience, though it be a Jewish one."
"Oh, nay, but," said Isaac, "thy master has won goodly steeds and rich armours with the strength of his lance and of his right hand. But 'tis a good youth. The Jew will take these in present payment and render him back the surplus."
"My master has disposed of them already," said Garth. That was wrong," said the Jew. "That was part of a fool. No Christians here could buy so many horses and armour. No Jew except myself who would give him half the values. But thou hast 100 zecchins with thee in that bag, said Isaac, prying under Garth's cloak. It is a heavy one.
Ah, I have heads for crossbows in it, said Garth readily.
Well then, said
Isaac, panting and hesitating between habitual love of gain and a newborn desire to be liberal in the present instance,
if I should say that I would take 80 zecchins for the good steed and rich armour, which leaves me not a guilder's profit, have you the money to pay me?
Ay, barely, said Garth, though the sum demanded was more reasonable than he had expected.
And it will leave my master nigh penniless. Nevertheless, if such be your least offer, I must be content. Oh, fill thyself another goblet of wine, said the Jew. 80 zecchins is too little. It leaveth no profit for the usages of the money. And besides, a good horse may have suffered wrong in this day's encounter. Oh, it was a hard and dangerous meeting. Man and steed, rushing on each other like wild bulls of Bashan. The horse cannot but have had wrong.
And I say, said Garth, he is sound of wind and limb, and you may see him now in your stable. And I say over and above that 70 zecchins is enough for the armour, and I hope a Christian's word is as good as a Jew's. If you will not take 70, I will carry this bag, and he shook it till the contents jingled, back to my master.
Oh, nay, nay, said Isaac, lay down the talents, the shekels, the 80 zecchins, and thou shalt see I will consider thee liberally.
Garth at length complied, and telling out 80 zecchins upon the table, the Jew delivered out of him an acquittance for the horse and suit of armour. The Jew's hand trembled for joy as he wrapped up the first 70 pieces of gold. The last 10 he told over with much deliberation, pausing and saying something as he took each piece from the table and dropped it into his purse. It seemed as if his avarice was struggling with his better nature and compelling him to pouch zecchin after zecchin, while his generosity urged him to restore some part at least to his benefactor or as a donation to his agent. His whole speech ran nearly thus.
71... 72, thy master is a good youth. 73, an excellent youth. 74, that piece has been clipped with the ring. 75, that looketh light of weight. 76, when thy master wants money, let him come to Isaac of York. 77, that is with reasonable security. Here he made a considerable pause,
and Garth had good hope that the last three pieces might escape the fate of their comrades, but the enumeration proceeded.
78, thou art a good fellow. 79, and deservest something for thyself.
Here the Jew paused again, and looked at the last zecchin, intending doubtless to bestow it upon Garth. He weighed it upon the tip of his finger, and made it ring by dropping it upon the table. Had it rung too flat, or had it felt a hair's breadth too light, generosity had carried the day, but unhappily for Garth, the chime was full and true, the zecchin plump, newly coined, and a grain above weight. Isaac could not find in his heart to part with it, so dropped it into his purse as if in absence of mind with the words,
80 completes the tale, and I trust thy master will reward thee handsomely. Surely, he added, looking earnestly at the bag, thou hast more coins in that pouch?
Garth grinned, which was his nearest approach to a laugh, as he replied,
About the same quantity which thou hast just told over so carefully.
He then folded the acquittance and put it under his cap, adding, Peril of thy bard, Jew, see that this be full and ample. He filled himself, unbidden, a third goblet of wine, and left the apartment without ceremony.
Oh, Rebecca, said the Jew, that Ishmaelite hath gone somewhat beyond me. Nevertheless, his master is a good youth. I am well pleased that he hath gained shekels of gold and shekels of silver, even by the speed of his horse and by the strength of his lance, which, like that of Goliath the Philistine, might vie with a weaver's beam.
As he turned to receive Rebecca's answer, he observed that during his chaffering with Garth, she had left the apartment unperceived. In the meanwhile, Garth had descended the stair, and having reached the dark antechamber or hall, was puzzling about to discover the entrance when a figure in white, shone by a small silver lamp which she held in her hand, beckoned him into a side apartment. Garth had some reluctance to obey the summons. Rough and impetuous as a wild boar, where only earthly force was to be apprehended, he had all the characteristic terrors of a Saxon, respecting fauns, forest fiends, white women, and the whole of the superstitions which his ancestors had brought with them from the wilds of Germany. He remembered, moreover, that he was in the house of a Jew, a people who, besides the other unamiable qualities which popular report ascribed to them, were supposed to be profound necromancers and cabalists. Nevertheless, after a moment's pause, he obeyed the beckoning summons of the apparition and followed her into the apartment which she indicated, where he found to his joyful surprise that his fair guide was the beautiful Jewess whom he had seen at the tournament and a short time in her father's apartment. She asked him the particulars of his transaction with Isaac, which he detailed accurately. "My father did but jest with thee, good fellow," said Rebecca. "He owes thy master deeper kindness than these arms and steeds could pay, were their value tenfold. What sum didst thou pay my father even now?"
80 zecchins, said Garth, surprised at the question.
"In this purse," said Rebecca, "you will find 100. Restore to thy master that which is his due, and enrich thyself with the remainder. Haste now, be gone. Stay not to render thanks, and beware how you pass through the crowded town, where you may easily lose both your burden and your life. Reuben," she added, clapping her hands together, "light forth this stranger, and fail not to draw lock and bar behind him." Reuben, a dark-browed and black-bearded Israelite, obeyed her summons with a torch in his hand, undid the outward door of the house, and conducted Garth across a paved court, let him out through a wicket in the entrance gate, which he closed behind him with such bolts and chains as would well have become that of a prison.
"By St. Dunstan," said Garth, as he stumbled up the dark avenue, "this is no Jewess, but an angel from heaven. 10 zecchins from my brave young master, 20 from this pearl of Zion. Oh, happy day! Such another Garth will redeem thy bondage and make thee a brother as free of thy guild as the best. And then do I lay down my swineherd's horn and staff and take the freeman's sword and buckler and follow my young master to the death without hiding either my face or my name."
Chapter 11. The nocturnal adventures of Garth were not yet concluded. Indeed, he himself became partly of that mind when, after passing one or two straggling houses, which stood in the outskirts of the village, he found himself in a deep lane, running between two banks overgrown with hazel and holly, while here and there a dwarf oak flung its arms together across the path. The lane was moreover much rutted and broken up by the carriages, which had recently transported articles of various kinds to the tournament, and it was dark, for the banks and bushes intercepted the light of the harvest moon. From the village were heard the distant sounds of revelry, mixed occasionally with loud laughter, sometimes broken by screams, and sometimes by wild strains of distant music. All these sounds intimating the disorderly state of the town, crowded with military nobles and their dissolute attendants, it gave Garth some uneasiness.
"Oy, the Jewess was right," he said to himself. "By heaven and St. Dunstan, I would I were safe at my journey's end with all this treasure. Here are such numbers, I will not say, of arrant thieves, but of errant knights and errant squires, errant monks and errant minstrels and errant jugglers and errant jesters. Man might with a single merc, he'd be in danger much more than a poor swineherd with a whole bag full of zecchins. Would I were out of the shade of these infernal bushes, that I might at least see any of St. Nicholas's clerks before they spring on my shoulders."
Garth accordingly hastened his pace in order to gain the open common to which the lane led, but was not so fortunate as to accomplish his object. Just as he attained the upper end of the lane, where the underwood was thickest, four men sprung upon him, even as his fears anticipated, two from each side of the road, and seized him so fast that resistance, if at first practicable, would have been now too late.
"Surrender your charge," said one of them. "We are the deliverers of the Commonwealth. Ease every man of his burden."
"You should not ease me of mine so lightly," muttered Garth, whose surly honesty could not be tamed, even by the pressure of immediate violence. "If I had it but in my power to give thee 3 strokes in its defence."
"Yeah, we will see that presently,"
said the robber, and speaking to his companions he added, "Bring along the knave. I see he would have his head broken as well as his purse cut, and so be let blood in two veins at once." Garth was hurried along, agreeably to this mandate, and having been dragged somewhat roughly over the bank, on the left-hand side of the lane, found himself in a straggling thicket, which lay between it and the open common. He was compelled to follow his rough conductors into the very depth of this cover, where they stopped unexpectedly in an irregular open space, free in a great measure from trees, and on which, therefore, the beams of the moon fell without much interruption from boughs and leaves. Here his captors were joined by two other persons, apparently belonging to the gang. They had short swords by their sides and quarterstaves in their hands, and Garth could now observe that all six wore visors, which rendered their occupation a matter of no question, even had their former proceedings left it in doubt.
"What money hast thou, Chill?" said one of the thieves.
"30 zecchins of my own property," answered Garth doggedly.
A forfeit, shouted the robbers. "A Saxon has 30 zecchins and will return sober from a village? An undeniable and unredeemable forfeit of all that he has."
"I ordered it to purchase more freedom," said Garth.
"Thou art an ass," replied one of the thieves. 3 quarts of double ale had rendered thee as free as thy master. Ay, and freer too, if he be a Saxon like thyself."
"Oh, sad truth," replied Garth. "But if those same 30 zecchins will buy my freedom from you, unloose my hands and I will pay them to you."
"Hold," said one who seemed to exercise some authority over the others. "This bag which you bear, as I can feel through your cloak, contains more coin than thou hast told us of."
"Oh, it is good night, my masters," answered Garth, "of which assuredly I would not have spoken a word had you been satisfied with working your will upon mine own property."
"Thou art an honest fellow," replied the robber, "I warrant, and we worship not St. Nicholas so devoutly, but what thy 30 zecchins may yet escape if thou deal uprightly with us. Meanwhile, render up thy trust for the time." So saying, he took from Garth's breast the large leather pouch in which the purse given him by Rebecca was enclosed, as well as the rest of the zecchins, and then continued his interrogation. "Who is thy master?"
"The disinherited knight," said Garth.
"Whose good lance," replied the robber, "won the prize in today's tourney. What is his name and lineage?"
"Well, it is his pleasure," answered Garth, "that they be concealed, and from me, assuredly, you will learn naught of them."
"What is thine own name and lineage?"
"Or to tell that," said Garth, "might be to reveal my master's."
"You are a saucy groom," said the robber, "but of that anon. How comes thy master by this gold? If it is of his inheritance, or by what means, has he accrued it to him?"
"By his good lance," answered Garth. "These bags contain the ransom of 4 good horses and 4 good suits of armour."
"How much is there?" demanded the robber.
200 zecchins.
"Only 200 zecchins," said the bandit. "Your master has dealt liberally by the vanquished and put them to a cheap ransom. Name those who paid the goal." Garth did so. "The armour and the horse of the Templar Brian de Bois Guilbert, at what ransom were they held? You see, you cannot deceive me."
"My master will take naught from the Templar, save his life's blood. They are on terms of mortal defiance, and cannot hold courteous intercourse together."
"Indeed," repeated the robber, and paused after he had said the word. "And what were you now doing at Ashby with such a charge in your custody?"
"I went hither to Isaac, the Jew of York," replied Garth. "The price of a suit of armour, which he had fitted my master for his tournament."
"And how much did you pay to Isaac? Methinks, to judge by the weight, there is still 200 zecchins in that pouch."
"I paid to Isaac," said the Saxon, 80 zecchins, and he restored me 100 in lieu thereof."
"How? What?" exclaimed all the robbers at once. "You dare to trifle with us? You tell such improbable lies."
"What I tell you," said Garth, "is as true as the moon is in heaven. You will find just some in a silken purse within the leathern pouch and separate from the rest of the gold."
"Bethink thee, man," said the captain, "you speak of a Jew, of an Israelite,
as unapt to restore gold as the dry sand of his deserts to return the cup of water which the pilgrim spills upon them.
There is no more mercy in them, said another of the banditti, than in the unbribed sheriff's officer.
It is, however, as I say, said Garth.
Strike a light instantly, said the captain. I will examine this said purse, and, if it be, as this fellow says, the Jew's bounty is little less miraculous than the stream which relieved his fathers in the wilderness.
A light was procured accordingly, and the robber proceeded to examine the purse. The others crowded around him, and even two who had hold of Garth relaxed their grasp while they stretched their necks to see the issue of the search. Availing himself of their negligence by a sudden exertion of strength and activity, Garth shook himself free of their hold, and might have escaped could he have resolved to leave his master's property behind him. But such was no part of his intention. He wrenched a quarterstaff from one of the fellows, struck down the captain, who was altogether unaware of his purpose, and had well nigh repossessed himself of the pouch and treasure. The thieves, however, were too nimble for him, and again secured both the bag and the trusty Garth.
"Knave!" said the captain, getting up. "You've broken my head, and with other men of our sort, you would fare the worse for thy insolence. But you shall know thy fate instantly. First, let us speak of thy master. The knight's matters must go before the squire's, according to due order of chivalry. Stand you fast in the meantime. If you stir again, you shall have that which will make thee quite for thy life. Comrades," he said, addressing his gang, "this purse is embroidered with Hebrew characters, and I well believe the yeoman's tale is true. The errant knight, his master, must needs pass toll-free. He is too like ourselves for us to make booty of him, since dogs should not worry dogs, where wolves and foxes are to be found in abundance."
"Like us?" answered one of the gang. "I should like to hear how that is made good."
"Why, you fool," answered the captain. "Is he not poor and disinherited as we are? Does he not win his substance at sword's point as we do? Hath he not beaten Front de Boeuf and Malvoisin, even though we would beat them if we could? Is he not the enemy to life and death of Brian de Bois Guilbert, whom we have so much reason to fear? And were all this otherwise, would you have us show a worse conscience than an unbeliever, a Hebrew Jew?"
"Oh, nay, that were a shame," muttered the other fellow. "And yet, when I served in the band of stout old Gandolin, we had no such scruples of conscience, and this insolent peasant, he too, I warrant me, is to be dismissed scatheless."
"Not if you can scathe him," replied the captain. "Here, fellow," continued he, addressing Garth, "can you use the staff that thou starts to it so readily?"
"Oh, I think," said Garth, "you shouldst best be able to reply to that question."
"Nay, by my truth, you gave me a round knock," replied the captain. "Do as much for this fellow, and you shall pass scot-free. And if you do not, why, by my faith, as you are such a sturdy knave, I think I must pay the ransom myself."
"Take your staff, Miller," he added, "and keep thy head, and do you others let the fellow go and give him a staff. There is light enough to lay on load by."
The two champions, being alike armed with quarter-staves, stepped forward into the centre of the open space in order to have the full benefit of the moonlight, the thieves in the meantime laughing and crying to their comrade, "Oh, Miller, beware thy toll-dish!" The miller, on the other hand, holding his quarter-staff by the middle and making it flourish around his head after the fashion which the French call faire le moulinet, exclaimed boastfully,
"Come on, churl, and thou darest, thou shalt feel the strength of a miller's thumb."
"Oh, if thou beest a miller,"
answered Garth undauntedly, making his weapon play around his head with equal dexterity,
"thou art doubly a thief, and I, as a true man, I bid you defiance."
I am the Lord.
have to leave our story of Ivanhoe. Garth about to go quarterstaff to quarterstaff with the miller. And who is the mysterious captain? Oh, I strongly suspect many of you have guessed. And what will happen with the disinherited knight? The melee will happen the next day. For those who may not know, a melee was a general all-in brawl. It was quite dangerous, and quite often you had tens, 30, 40, 50 even, on either side going hammer and tongs. It was a brutal age. At any rate, till next week, take care, Braidwood. I was